Okay, it isn't the Missouri, but it's, would it be the same type class as, say, the Belfast?
Yes, yeah, very similar to the Belfast. She was county class, whereas the Belfast was what they call the city class, named after cities.
Yes.
Belfast, I think, were a little bigger, but
because,
not much.
Well, Belfast is in on the Thames River in London.
Yes.
Know. It's a floating museum,
yeah.
And I attempted to take a picture of it with a wide-angle lens and couldn't get it all in, and I was on the other side of the river, so these are mammoth vessels.
Yeah, I've forgotten just what the measurements of the Belfast were, but...
Well, what did it feel to command this power, I guess, is what it is.
Yes, you're very conscious of the power. She had 72,000 horsepower in her engine rooms.
Firepower would be...
She had triple turrets.
How big an inch? Do you recall the inch on the gun?
6 inch, I think she was.
6 inch gun?
Yeah. I think she was only 6 inch, yes. I'm sure she was. So long ago.
I'm sorry.
And I've been reading so much. Yes, I'm sure she was 6 inch. Triple 6 inch. Nine triple. And nine total. 6 inch.
Did you feel invincible? I know it's a silly question, but...
invincibility depends on the crew, and during our time, weren't very capable of manning all the equipment and so on. It requires years of training and
so on.
That's
been fabulous training, though, for the soldiers and the sailors, I should say.
Yes, it was very good. I was very criticized on one occasion. I carried a reserve petty officer from Vancouver who I didn't know, but turned out to be a reporter from the Sun, and on one visit back to Esquimalt, I went to see the Admiral, who threw in front of me this newspaper, and it said that Uganda training ship was going from one spot on the BC coast where the fishing was good to another spot where the fishing was good. So he said, what have you got to say about that? He'd given me very much a free hand to do what I wanted to do. So I simply said that I thought that when it came down to training ordinary seamen, I could do it equally well where the fishing was good as I could where it was bad.
Yeah.
And he said simply, I see what you mean. And that was the end of the conversation. The press did everything they could to make it uncomfortable.
Well, they didn't change the name. It was kept as Uganda.
It kept as Uganda until 47. I put her into refit.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ontario came out to relieve us of our responsibility. And she went into refit. And when she was recommissioned, came out of,
mm-hmm.
She came out as HMCS Quebec.
She came out as a Quebec gun.
Yeah. So
you stayed for refit until when? Late 47?
No, I didn't. I was... the moment she went into refit, I was hauled off to Ottawa. And I went to Ottawa, was reappointed as... I was boast of the fact that I relieved two captains. And 2 years later, I was relieved by two captains. I took over the job of Deputy Chief of Naval Personnel and also Director of Naval Reserves. And it was a very busy office. There was a great deal going on. And that was the time when we were thinking of reorganizing, putting a little Canadiana into our... structure, and we changed the nomenclature of the men to something which was typically Canadian, a little breakaway from the Royal Navy, and all this was thought out and invented when I was DCNP.
Be what, about 7,000 men in the Navy at this point, or is it increasing?
It's increasing. I would think about 7,000 to 8,000 men, yes.
And you
although
would,
it's a little difficult to remember
yes,
this
yes,
far.
Yes, of course,
back.
Certainly. Yeah. How did you feel about money? Lots of money was starting to be spent. We're talking about, 48, 49, we're talking $251 million. And yet the Air Force is getting the big chunk of the money. They're getting the major percentage.
Yeah.
Was this annoying, or did you feel fine about this, or?
Well, we, we can't deny that the Air Force was the glamour service. And, they were deserving of getting a good their share of the money, and if you can't all get it at once, we hope that they would get it 1 year and we pick it up the next.
Well, what was happening by the 50s though is the Navy's getting 13-14% of the budget, and the Air Force is getting 41.
Yeah.
And that didn't cause much dissension at all, or?
Well, I can't say it bothered me particularly. We were very happy with what we'd got.
It just bothers me to have the figures on it.
Yeah.
When did you go to carriers? You remained in Ottawa for what, a couple of years? And
yes, I stayed in Ottawa for 2 years, and in 49 I was appointed to HMCS Magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in dry dock when I joined her in St. John, New Brunswick. And the first time I took her to sea was simply from St. John's back to Halifax. And then we went, we had sent a lot of our airmen down to the United States and to be trained in American carriers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first trip we did, we went down to pick them up. While we were doing training off the coast and flying, we suddenly got a message. We had no qualified pilots at all. We got a message to go and help look for an American aircraft, which was down with 18 men on board, just north of Bermuda. So we started off for Bermuda, and every now and again we'd turn up in the wind and fly off some airplanes and land them back on and qualify them as qualified pilots. And this way we got quite a backlog of qualified pilots. This was in the infancy of flying. And
how did it feel to command this flat top now? He seemed to be getting bigger all the time.
Yes, that's true. Well, it didn't bother me at all. I rather enjoyed it. I was flattered to be chosen to go to the Magnificent. And I was very happy to be with these flyboys. And I assured them that the policy of the ship would be in their support. The ship had a flat deck off which airplanes were supposed to fly, and all of us who were born in the ship, not flyboys, were there to be of service to them. So this gave them great encouragement and so on. So we went on.
Well, we have NATO starting up at this time also, the Atlantic Charter, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and Pearson and this type of thing now. How did you feel about it? Were you excited about getting involved with this, joint military operations?
Oh, we were bound to get involved as time went on in exercises. And
yes, of course,
thing, but these were the formative stages.
Did you enjoy that? Were you looking forward to it?
No. Yes, I was looking forward to it, but it didn't bother us. The only time I was in the Magnificent for just a little over 2 years, and we joined up with an American fleet in the West Indies on one occasion, and we had some British ships. Well, that was the only time that I worked with international effort.
You mentioned before that in 50 you went to Europe and you were most disappointed that you went to France and Germany, and there were a lot of goods in the stores and this and that.
Oh, yeah.
And the, I wonder if you could relate that again, please.
Well, we I went to England, and we took three destroyers with us, I think. This was at the time when Korea broke. We were supposed to take five destroyers, and or was it six? And three destroyers had to fly off to Korea, and it was when Korea first broke out. And we were in Europe with the other destroyers.
Now, you were on destroyers again at this time?
No, I was in Magnificent.
You were still with Magnificent?
Yeah.
Okay.
We took her to England, first of all, to Londonderry, where we did a course with the anti-submarine course, the anti-submarine school there, and went to sea with submarines and escort vessels and so on, and put into practice what we thought we had learned, and with actual submarines and so on. But we stuck it out for 3 or 4 days, but the weather got so bad we had to come in. It wasn't very pleasant for the destroyers. Then we went from Northern Ireland to Scotland, and from Scotland to Norway, Norway to France, back to England and Portsmouth, and then around to Portugal and Gibraltar, and to Bermuda and back to Halifax. That was the cruise. So we visited all NATO, all NATO countries, and it was a tremendous experience. I was very proud of the Canadian men on this. Their behavior was exemplary. They there were no punishments necessary for misbehavior, drunkenness, or everything. They just behaved themselves beautifully, and they were all young men, you know, and but very conscious of the fact that they had Canada flashes on there. It was great to see them carry this.
What flag did you fly? Did you still fly the White Ensign, or is that only for one time?
Oh yeah, we flew the White Ensign.
You flew the White?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're mentioning, though, that you were disappointed with what the poor English beat the victors had to.
Oh yes, we've in all these countries, we found that the poorest of them, the people who were suffering the most, were the English. This would be in 1951 or 1950. In Italy, who'd lost the war, they had everything they could buy. It was expensive, but it was there and available. The shops were full. In France, there was, everything was opulence. Lots of good food and clothing. The shops were loaded and so on. You could buy anything you wanted. But poor old England, there was nothing available, and made you think, I wonder if it pays to be the winner of a war. Certainly nobody wins in a war, I know that, but England certainly financially didn't win the last one.
There's a line you use, the daughters of, well, the girls of England were dressed in their mothers.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's just almost a saying that the girls of England are dressed in their mother's curtains.
Curtains, that's right.
That's hardly true, and but I think it was true of the Norwegian girls when we got in there with Prince Olaf in 1945. Mm. The Norwegian girls had nothing. Nothing.
How long did you stay with Magnificent?
2 years. 2 years and 2 months.
2 years and 2 months. Would that be the best command?
You mean for me?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that was the best command I had. I wouldn't say it was the one I enjoyed the most.
Enjoyed the Uganda the most, or?
Well, very difficult to decide. They're both different commands. As a ship, pure and simply as a ship from the pure sailor's point of view, I enjoyed Uganda more than Magnificent because she had the power. And
it's got a pointy end at the front.
Yeah. Whereas the Magnificent had only about half that horsepower. It was a lot more ship.
What did you do after this? You went back to Ottawa from personnel, or what?
No, in 1951, I left Stadacona, or left
Magnificent,
and I was transferred out to Naden, out here.
Oh, really?
I came out to Naden, and I commanded Naden for a year and a half.
You're still a captain at this time, is that correct?
No, I was promoted to Commodore when I went to Magnificent.
You were promoted Commodore?
Yeah.
Why? Because it was the carrier that much more responsibility?
Yes. Well, I was, not only was I in command of the carrier itself, but I also commanded any Canadian ships. I was senior Canadian naval officer afloat. So I commanded all ships at sea. It's rather an admiral's command.
Mm-hmm.
But there are occasions when you get 14, 15 ships with you. And
14 captains.
Yeah, and you had to have one person in command of the works.
Now, you drove your own boat as the Commodore, is that correct? Or did you?
Yes, I was captain of the Magnificent and also admiral commanding all the rest. The Americans produced a short title for it, Conflit. Meaning senior Canadian naval officer afloat. This sounded rather like an insect killer.
Yeah. When you came out to Naden, well, what was the duties at Naden?
Well, once again, training and...
Now you say Naden, though, not Dockyard, no. Now,
no.
Today, the Admiral lives in Dockyard and commands the whole... His deputy maritime commander, whatever, and commands his whole west coast and half of Alberta, or whatever the hell it is.
It's entirely different setup nowadays with what I was in. The job of Naden, I don't think, exists as such now. But running a barracks was a different function under this unification, under the new rules. Don't ask me to explain it. I think it's too complicated for anybody to understand. But in my day, it was all relatively simple. My job was to look after personnel. And the personnel on the coast was my responsibility. And I was responsible to the admiral for that function.
Now, was there a rear admiral in Dockyard?
Yes.
Who would that be?
That was Admiral Creary. Wallace Creary.
Well, how was he to work for? Or with?
Oh, he was fine. He wasn't here very much. He was quite ill. And he took off and went to England for a holiday or something. And being second in command of the coast, I took over the total responsibility.
How do you like commanding out here?
Oh, it's peacetime is... very simple. I think that I enjoyed it.
Well, your forte is personnel, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm very, very interested in personnel. Always have been.
Now, you didn't have the benefit of the staff college, is that right?
No. Didn't. Everything I learned about staff work, I learned the hard way.
Well, that would make you a pretty rare bird, I guess, in the sense that...
No, I think that there were a lot of us who were due for staff training at about that period. And we didn't get any staff training.
Hmm.
And by the time the war was over, I guess too late to make amends. So
damage had already been done.
Damage had already been done. And so I missed out on all that staff training. But I've had a lot of staff experience. And I think had I had the advantage of staff training, I probably would have been a better staff officer. But I managed to struggle through it.
How long did you remain at Maiden?
About a year and a half. And then I went for my last job in the Navy. When I had been in Ottawa as Deputy Chief of Naval Personnel and Director of Naval Reserves, I thought it was very wrong that the Reserve Command should be directed from Ottawa. And the importance...
Why is this?
Well, if you got into a hassle for money or something, it was the easiest thing in the world for the reserves to come out of the race last. And I didn't think it was fair. All the time I was Deputy Chief of Naval Personnel and Director of Naval Reserves, I had to fight with myself all the time.
With your different hats.
With the different hats, yes. And I thought it was wrong, and I put forward a paper to naval staff suggesting that a separate command should be created for reserves. This I firmly believed in, and I thought that it was right and proper because the reserves had proved themselves to be absolutely invaluable during the war. So invaluable, in fact, that they were 99.9% of us.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was reserves. And I figured that they should not become secondary citizens in the Navy. And the only way I could see to support this belief was the creation of a separate command. Well, Naval Board accepted the plan, but unfortunately at the time they didn't have any senior officer who could accept the responsibility. So little did I expect, but when I finished in Naden, they found that I was available and I was sent down to Hamilton, Ontario to create the command that I'd invented. It was a big surprise to me. I never expected.
Were you promoted to Sun Rear Admiral? Or?
No, I was started that job as a Commodore, and I think it took about 2 years in the job before I was promoted to an Admiral. I was very happy to take it on this responsibility because I believed in the Naval Reserves and.
Had your love as personnel anyway, and just this whole administrative.
Yes. Added to which.
Weren't there accusations that you created this job just for yourself?
No way. I was very surprised to be selected. I thought that there might be a younger and more bumpy.
I'm just giving you a hard time, sir.
At about this time, Lord Louis Mountbatten, Admiral of the Fleet, came out from England and expressed to the Chief of Naval Staff some ideas about publicity for the Navy. We'd always lived under the sheltering cry of the Silent Navy.
Silent Service.
And the Silent Service and so on. And I guess Admiral Mountbatten was the first to appreciate that we can't live that way. We've got to keep the taxpayers informed of where their money is going and how essential it is that it should go in that direction. So, along with Cond, the commanding officer naval division's job, I was elected to take on and do some publicity for the Navy, which actually, in my opinion, became to be about 60% of my job. And I started off with great enthusiasm. I was first sent down to Washington to do a course in public relations. And this I did, I enjoyed, and came back full of vim, vigor, and vitality, and started off across the country. I think I did a fairly good job. It was reported editorially in some newspapers across the country at the time that if I continue to talk in the simple, straightforward manner that I was doing, I was bound to be successful. And I think that newspapers and everything appreciated a kind of an open attitude. I wasn't scared of anybody. And although I was told, you know, they have a clipping service in Ottawa, and I was asked, ministerial inquiries came out pretty regularly, which didn't scare me too much. I realized somebody was feeding the minister this stuff, and I tried to avoid anything that was not within my
sphere. How did you find getting to the politicians? Or the civil servants, the mandarins?
Personally, I'd liked dealing with politicians. Our political masters, as we used to call them.
Mm-hmm.
I think they did the best they could within what they was allowed them by my cabinet. I never found any difficulty with them. They may have found difficulty with me. I'm sure they did. I know for a fact that I wasn't as popular as I might have been. But
if you're not popular, you're getting nothing done. I don't
know. But I thoroughly enjoyed my time in I stayed there for 5 years. I was reaching the end of my tether, you know, coming to the age limit where I had to retire.
What was the age limit then?
55.
55 as it is today.
And I was gradually approaching that time. We built the reserve up to a pretty high standard and pretty capable. We tried to develop more seagoing forces for them. We had maximum number of 15 ships on the Great Lakes, all designed to train reserves at one time. And it was very beneficial. We tried specializing in training, tried to develop it so that different divisions would do different things. And it all went very well indeed. After 2 years of it, we'd built up our numbers to very, very considerably. And being a volunteer force, it's no mean task.
Well, after your retirement, did you still maintain a connection with the reserves and the...
No, very difficult to do. Very difficult.
Why
to
is that?
Maintain. Well, I maintained for a few years a connection through the Naval Officers Association and that kind of thing, but through the actual reserve, very difficult for me as an admiral to interfere with the activities of some smaller local unit.
In other words, it's best just to move along and let them can carry on.
And be as encouraging to them as you possibly can.
Well, what year would this be then, your retirement then would be? 58.
58? Yeah. Just 20 years ago.
Well, a lot's changed in the last 20 years. We've had unification.
Yes. Yeah.
Except for the ships. Sorry, I had to say that.
Yeah.
Everything's changed with the ships.
Everything's changed with the ships. Of course, I believe the ships have been
very
modernized. And
oh yeah, they're all tiddly inside. I mean, you know, they don't have the old they're all super controlled and things, but we talked a bit about the unification business and the one Canadian force and colonels at sea.
Yes.
How does that affect, like, your colleagues now? You know Admiral Budge and Landy Moore and these other people. When you do get together, do you discuss these matters at all, or is it just...
Not very much, no. I think we realize it's flogging a dead horse.
Flogging a dead horse.
Yes, and I think all of us appreciate the fact that it's up to the young men in the service.
It's a young man's job now.
Yeah. And if it is acceptable, the way things are going, if it's acceptable to all of them, if they've still got a good form of discipline and morale and so on, I'm afraid that I couldn't find any reason to fight it. I certainly wouldn't want to fight it just for the sake of fighting it, because it wasn't what I had.
Mm-hmm. Well, there seems to be a lot of dissension, though, in the sense that, I've heard this comment made, for example, that the Navy, because Landy Moore went out and played it above board in that sense, whereas other less scrupulous, say, Army types back in Ottawa said yes, unification, and at the same time were pushing things to separate, like the regiments to remain the same, and regimental patches on the uniforms instead of Canada, that's PBCLI or Royal 22nd, yeah. Whatever. Regimental buttons coming back in, whereas yeah. The Navy's not allowed to have an anchor, but the regiments are allowed to have regimental buttons, this type of thing. Though it's petty.
Yeah.
If we really
face this thing, no regiment is complete of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in the Army organization, a regiment is an essential thing for support of morale and mm-hmm. so on. The moment they destroy the regiment as such, they've destroyed an awful lot. But no regiment is completely self-supporting. They have to have other regiments of other employment in order to feed mm-hmm. them and to support them. The Navy is a regiment completely self-contained.
The ship's company
feeds itself, it repairs itself, it supplies itself, it pays itself. It does everything within that ship. And they're all Navy folk. Now, if they pay more attention to the regiment on the one hand, and the Navy don't recognize the fact that the Navy is a complete regiment in itself, I think it's wrong. The Navy cannot be dependent on anybody else. I sat with on a committee in Ottawa at one time with the unification of punishment, for instance. And when the other two services learned of the powers that we had as commanding officer of a ship,
spiritual life and death power, isn't it?
No, it's not as bad as that, but
it's
very extensive. And it must be, because ships are off by themselves, and mm-hmm. if you mm-hmm. get some major misdemeanor, it's got to be dealt with right away. And they were very surprised to find out this, so they jumped on our bandwagon, and the system of dealing with petty crime, you might say, in the Air Force and the Navy became strictly naval, and therefore it was a good thing. It didn't limit the Navy. We were scared stiff that they were going to limit us down to Army standards and so on, but the Army was quick to realize that we had advantage. Well, that's
a question of self-interest and power, I mean.
That's right. that was a good thing insofar as the unification or the integration was concerned. I'm a great believer that integration, there were so many things that could have been integrated.
Probably, yes.
But integration what went on, I think, was criminal. And there was, everybody talked at the time about economy.
What economy?
The economy meant that you had to have three generals and where you had one before. And everybody got promoted
mm-hmm.
out of it.
There's no privates left, they're all corporals.
No.
The privates are the corporals now, are the privates yeah. of your day, yes.
Before unification, there used to be three, in the medical profession, there used to be three commodores, three people of commodore, equal rank, heading the armed forces. When they integrated, they left the three commodores, but they put in one of major general over the top of them.
Can't have three commodores running loose. Brigadiers.
And that happened throughout the service. So there's no economy in it. Anybody that thinks there's economy, it's crazy.
I won't take any more of your time today. Thank you very much.
Have you pushed that thing?
I'll push it down right now.